Majesties, brother presidents and prime ministers. 15 years ago, I had the onerous responsibility to make this statement somewhere. There comes, in all political struggles, rare moments, hard to distinguish, but fatal to let slip, when even caution is dangerous. Then all must be set on a hazard, and out of a simple man is ordained strength. We who have been called to leadership have the privilege and the high responsibility of determining to a very large extent the future of Africa. It lies very much within our collective power to determine if our people who live on the world's richest continent shall exploit these resources in our own interest or for the primary benefit of our own people. It lies within our power to redress the monstrous crimes of imperialist history by setting Africa on the high road to full and meaningful freedom. The decision we make here now will not only influence the lives of the 280 million inhabitants of our continent today. These decisions will influence the course of events for countless generations of Africans yet unborn. I have always maintained that in the present state of world affairs, the United Nations is the only hope for the preservation of internal peace and security. It is true that for a long time, its deliberations were dominated by Europe and America. And it's only within the last 7 or 8 years that Africa's voice has become articulate and forceful within the forum of the United Nations. The work of the United Nations should be so organized that there will be equitable representation, and that these organs should not be dominated by any power. There must be universality of membership of the United Nations in accordance with the principles of the Charter, so that all states of the world, including the People's Republic of China, may be made a contribution to our since we met Addis Ababa and established the Organization of African Unity, I have had no reason for the concrete proposal which I made to you then or above the reasons I gave for my conviction that only a union government can guarantee Africa's survival. On the contrary, every hour, the world at large and on our own continent has brought events to prove that our problems as individual states are insoluble, except in the context that our security as individual states is indivisible of the whole continent. That freedom of our convictions still in foreign chains and under colonial rule awaits the redeeming might of Africa. At the summit meeting at Addis Ababa last year, no amount of disappointment or impatience that our charter has been implemented cannot make it an irrevocable nature of our decision to affirm the unity of Africa. It was an act of faith, a recognition of reality. we forge the organization of African unity, fully conscious of all the difficulties facing our various peoples, in committing themselves to a common obligation. We have passed from the first year victorious over trials of our loyalty and over hostile forces seeking to destruct our unity. Whenever and wherever the subsidiary body set up by the Addis Ababa Charter has met the spirit of unity, of cooperation, and of goodwill, have been made. On that score, none of us can complain. None of us have called to doubt the strength and permanence of spirit of unity which found its expression in our time. Yet, even more than last year, I must urge the historical conditions in which African independence has emerged and the concrete manifestation of our weaknesses and difficulties call for immense radical and urgent measures which the Addis Ababa Conference did not take. Measures which would have been accounted adequate for dealing with our problems 3 years ago cannot now meet the exigencies of the African Revolution. It is not single states or single continents which are undergoing decolonization, but the greater portion of the world. It is not one empire which is expiring, but one where the whole system of imperialism which is at bay. It is not individual communities, but the whole of humanity which is demanding a different and better way of life for the world's growing millions. Great, positive, and social revolutions have created the mighty nations and empires. And the waves of those revolutions lap our shores no less than they do those of other continents. Great technological and industrial revolutions have transformed the economies of large portions of the world. And the waves of those revolutions will not stop short on the continent of Africa. A revolution in communication brings knowledge to every change in the world to the remotest corners of Africa. The world will not wait, nor will it be fully accomplished. It is against this background of great political, social, cultural, and scientific and technological revolutions that the emergence of African independence and the development of Africa must be viewed. None of us imagines that we can keep our own peace, immune from interferences, isolated from the world's upsurges and revolutions. What differences there are between us arise from a difference in appreciation of the sense of urgency and not in the understanding we have of our tasks and responsibilities. Time, indeed, is the crucial factor. For time acts for those who use it with purpose and not for those who let it slip by. Those who do not use time as their agent give the advantage to those who do. When we met last year, we were at the beginning of an era of peaceful coexistence. The risk of a world war was abating, and the prospect of peaceful cooperation between great powers appeared to bring to an end the struggle of foreign influences in Africa. We embraced non-alignment in order to escape involving ourselves in the prevailing Cold War politics. Indeed, instead, you have witnessed the menacing upset of imperialism and the revival of colonialism itself in Africa, and foreign interferences and subversion in the internal affairs of our African state. The one essential factor which united us at Addis Ababa, the overriding factor which made all differences and difficulties seem trivial and irrelevant, was the need to free that portion of our continent which is still in the grip of imperialism. In spite of our charter, in spite of our resolutions, in spite of our common front at the United Nations and in other international gatherings, what have we witnessed? Far from deterring the imperialist and the neo-colonialist from giving support to the apartheid regime in South Africa and to the fascist regime in Portugal, the NATO powers, on the contrary, have poured and are pouring vast sums of money and vast armament into the apartheid regime of South Africa and Portugal. Not only is South Africa being assisted to grow stronger economically and militarily, but the cruelty, repression, and exploitation of our African brothers have reached new heights. The enormous task of liberating our continent cannot be undertaken in a spirit of compromise and surrender. By raising a threat at Addis Ababa and not being able to take effective action against apartheid and neo-colonialism, we have worsened the plight of our kinsmen in Angola, in Mozambique, Southern Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and South Africa. We have frightened the imperialists sufficiently to strengthen their defenses and repression in Southern Africa. But we have not frightened them enough to abandon apartheid supremacy to its ill-fitted doom. It must be said that by merely making resolutions on African unity and not achieving our goal of a union government of Africa, we have made our task of freeing the rest of the African continent harder and not easier. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization powers have not been deterred one bit from sending all the arms needed by Salah's regime to keep down our kinsmen in his colony. The Portuguese fascist regime has not made a single move to negotiate with the United Nations or with the nationalist forces. It has become more insolent, more mendacious, and more repressive since our conference in Addis Ababa. Mr. Chairman, what has gone wrong? The imperialists regarded our charter of unity as a token unity. That's all. They will not respect it until it assumes the form of a union government. It is incredible that they will defy a united continent. But it is easy to understand that they do not believe that we will be able to accomplish the next stage, to organize and centralize our economic and military and political forces to wage a real struggle against apartheid, Portuguese fascism, and those who support those evils. We have not yet made the imperialists to believe that we can set our continent in order as a mighty economic force capable of standing together as a united and progressive people. Serious border disputes have broken out and disturbed our continent since our last meeting. Fortunately, good sense and African solidarity have prevailed in all these instances. But the disputes have been smothered, not settled. The artificial divisions of African states are too numerous and irrational for for real, permanent, harmonious settlement to be achieved, except within the framework of a continental union government. Mr. President, how, for example, can we prevent the people of Western Somalia, whose whole livelihood is cattle grazing, from continuing to look for fresh fields for grazing by traveling beyond traditional barriers without bringing them into clashes with their competitors in the world? And yet, in a united Africa, Ethiopian lands and Somalia lands, even though they may be separately sovereign within the framework of Union Government of Africa, would belong to a common goal which would assist the general development of cattle rearing in that part of our continent, because there would be no artificial barriers to such development. The benefit of the development would be for the benefit of both Ethiopia and Somalia. I said a little while ago, and I repeat, that the real border disputes will grow with the economic development and national strengthening of the African states as separate, balkanized governmental units. That was the historical process of the developing states in other continents. We cannot expect Africa, with its legacy of artificial borders, to follow any other call unless we make a positive effort to arrest that danger now. And we can do so only under a new government. In other words, the careers and ambitions of political leaders on one hand and the balkanized nationalism on the other, if allowed to grow and become entrenched, could constitute a break on the unification of African states. The Balkan states of Europe are a lesson for us. History has shown that where the great powers cannot colonize, they balkanize. This is what they did to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and this is what they have done and are doing in Africa. If we allow ourselves to be balkanized, we shall be recolonized and be picked up one after another. Now is the time for Africa's political and economic unification. Mr. Chairman, by far, the greatest wrong which the departed colonialists inflicted on us, on Africa, and which we now continue to inflict on ourselves, is the present state of disunity. And to leave us divided into economically unviable states which bear no responsibility for real development. As long as the chief consideration of our industrialized nations was our raw materials at their own price, this policy made sense for them, but not for us. Now that their technological impetus is such that they need Africa even more as a market for their manufactured goods than as a source of raw material, our economic backwardness no longer makes sense for them anymore than for us. The output of their great industrial complexes is no longer the primitive and simple implement of the hoes and the shovels. They now need faster and more prosperous markets for heavy agricultural tractors and electronic machines. They wish to sell to us not Ford motors propelled by magnetos and turboprop, transport aircraft, but the latest supersonic jets and atomic-powered machine vessels. Which of us, trading separately in these highly developed market areas, can survive more than a year or two without remaining either economically backward, indebted, bankrupt, or recolonized? There is such There is much rethinking on this call among the industrialized advanced countries. Although their outlook is obscure because their economies are still geared to monolithic devices for getting hold of our oil and gas deposits, uranium, gold, diamond, and other raw materials cheap, and selling their manufactured goods back to us at exorbitant prices. The poverty of the developing world has become a blot on the ethics and common sense of the industrialized nations.